Hello and welcome to another episode of Lit Up with Nina Alvarez. I'm your host, Nina Alvarez. This week we have on a very special guest, Ellen Hilfiker. Is it Hilfiker or Hilfiker?
Ficker.
I've known you for so long and I still feel like I always get this wrong. Well, Ellen has been a client of mine for about a year and a half now, and he's a very prolific writer, and he has a number of books coming out this year that I'm very excited to talk with him about. Ellen has really wide and interesting history. He started out at the University of Rochester, and he became a lawyer. And over the last 40 years, he put aside what it turned out to be a really very generous endowment to the University of Rochester. And he's also, along the way, been writing poems and short stories, and he's working on a novel. So I thought Ellen would be a great person to come on and learn about his process and why he writes and all that sort of stuff. So welcome to the show, Ellen.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you here. Well, I'd like to start with your earliest memory, I guess, of wanting to write.
Well, Nina, that really, if I think back correctly, that goes back to when I was four or five or six. I'm not sure exactly when. I had a reverence for books, and I was reminded of this the other day. I pulled out one of the childhood books that my mother had saved, and I noticed that I had written the alphabet on the inside of the title page, the reverse side of the title page. And I remember at the time why I did that. I guess I had this desire to say something, and I wasn't able to articulate a specific thought, but I figured if I wrote the alphabet, I would have said everything there possibly could, you could possibly say in an encapsulized form. So I guess that was something that was inherent within me, a desire not only for books, but a desire for writing and composition. I didn't really get started on anything seriously until college years, where I dabbled with some short stories and a few poems. And now, some 50 years later, I've decided to publish a few of the things that I have written on. I guess you could say it's hobby writing with a little bit of compulsion involved with it. My wife would say a heavy dose of compulsion.
Yeah. So your first short stories in college, what were they about? Do you remember any of those?
Basically, I've thrown them all away. I think they were pretty much junk. Nothing too special. The ones that I started writing, probably 20, 30 years ago, I think have a little more substance to them. One that I like, and I think you've read, is Old Soldiers.
Yes.
It's about two World War II veterans, one a German who became a priest, and the other an American who became a judge. And it turns out that, ironically, they each killed each other's brother. That has a certain, in my mind, created a certain irony and poignancy that I liked. And then there are a bunch of others. I'm not sure you'd be able to pick out some of the themes that are existing in these stories, but I'll leave that to you and others who may choose to read them.
Well, that leads me to Findings Off the Road, which is a short story collection that you'll have coming out hopefully quite soon, I'm assuming over the next couple months. I'm working with Ellen to get these self-published, and we actually have a review copy in front of us. And Dan, who's our helping out with sound today, actually wrote, I think, a quite nice description of the collection, which starts with Old Soldiers. And one of the things that Dan writes about your collection and that I agree with is that they're keenly observed encounters, ordinary men grappling with forces of man in the natural world. Tough choices, hard moral choices, and always an undercurrent of compassion. There's a lot of stories in which someone forgives an enemy, lets an animal go, chooses to live peaceably in order to heal something, it seems. And I'm wondering if you have noticed these thematic undercurrents in your writing and if you attribute them to anything that you think about, that you learned about your own life along the way.
Well, many of them, particularly those that involve hunting and fishing, deal with specific experiences that I've had, catching a trout, seeing how beautiful it was, and then releasing it. There's quite a bit of sensitivity in some of those stories. I am very interested in World War II, mm-hmm. Particularly the Eastern Theater. It really fascinates me, the history there. So there are several stories about World War II. A lot of what I've written, just are spot ideas that come to you. And as I said right at the outset, it's sort of a compulsion. You think of something, you mull it around for a few days, you say, I don't know, should I bother with that? And then finally you say, yeah, you just got to do it. It's got to come out. You've got to express it. And where those ideas come from, I really can't say, but I suspect it's true with people who are painters. They see a specific scene that they want to paint, or someone's face that intrigues them and they want to do that, or wherever the ideas come from, who knows. Many of them are based on experiences of either myself or my family. My wife had a kidney transplant 6 or 7 years ago, and there's a lot of sensitivity that goes into that. For example, you don't know who the donor of the kidneys are unless it's a friend or a family member that agrees to provide one. And the hospitals are very careful about keeping that information private. One of the stories, it's called The Transplant, intrigued me, dealing with a very rabid racist who just couldn't tolerate minorities sort of a stuffy, very wealthy individual, but one who received a transplant, and then through a friend revealing a newspaper article, he found out that it came from an African American, and that to me, the irony of that was something that I just felt I wanted to
yes.
To write about, to show that we all are, I guess you could say, children of the same God.
Beautiful, beautifully put. I have found a lot of, you know, you said before that you consider yourself like a hobbyist writer, but I found that you write a sort of literary fare that it betrays a lot of years of work and craft and thought. I was wondering if you had anything that you like to read or anything that you has inspired you as a writer.
Well, I guess like any would-be writer, you'd have to go to Hemingway and Fitzgerald, certainly for 20th century authors. I keep rereading their works, their novels, Hemingway's short stories, and
yeah.
I think it's a mistake to try to pattern yourself after another writer. I wish I had the flair that Fitzgerald displays on occasion. It's just beautiful prose. Anyway, you have to do it your own way, and if you don't, why, it's probably going to be a failure, maybe a failure anyway. But if you're true to your craft and true to yourself, I think you may have a chance. One thing that's true about me and my attempts at writing and drafting that I do as a lawyer, I tend to review and revise and revise and revise, and I'm reminded of something I believe that Auden said at one time about his poems and his writings. He said they're never really completed. They're at some point simply abandoned. That's what I have to discipline myself. Okay, Al, it's time to quit. You've worked on this enough, and this is probably the best you're going to come up with. So,
and it's pretty good. I have something that I've been wanting to dig into with you for a while, and what better time than with the public? You have done this really extraordinary thing, which has taken years and years to put together money to donate to the University of Rochester's English department. And I think this is an exceptional thing. You were a lawyer. You didn't become a professor. You didn't take this money and give it to the law department. Is there a law department?
There's certainly not at the University of Rochester, but there is certainly at my at my alma mater, Cornell Law School.
Cornell, where you went for, exactly. Mm-hmm. And this is money you could have done. You could have started businesses. You could have traveled the world. I'd love to know what it is that, I guess, inspired you to do this.
Okay, well, I guess I've tried to sort that out myself. It starts with, I guess, the very first day of my first class, at 8 o'clock on Monday morning in September of 1956, when it was an English class, as I say, an 8 o'clock. I got there very, very early. I was a city kid. I didn't want to be late. And I was just struck. I was inspired. I was just, I never got over it. And to this day, I don't think I've ever gotten over it, that holy cow, this is just going to be a terrific experience. And it carried through for all of my undergraduate years and certainly the years following that. And you've probably heard the expression grateful patient in connection with donors to hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I guess you could say I was a grateful student. Grateful for the experience that I had, the inspiration that I had at the University of Rochester. I wanted to establish a scholarship, particularly for first-generation kids and for minorities. I think that's very important to help our minorities become fully absorbed and integrated into our society, and we got a long ways to go. And I was also extremely impressed with the professors, I believe you have to focus your largesse or your giving, and I decided to focus on the English department and the humanities, and that's, I feel, very well placed, so that, and hopefully kids will benefit from this, and that we'll their lives will be enriched as I feel mine has.
And can you tell us again the name of the actual professorship? It's like the full title that you've endowed.
Oh, yeah. It's a little grandiose. It's the Alan F. Hilfiker Distinguished Professorship for in English.
And this was just installed last year, right? 2014.
Yes, April of 2014.
And the first professor to receive it was, what, do you remember his name?
Yeah, oh, sure.
Oh, you probably
yeah.
know.
Yeah, I better.
Yeah.
Kenneth Gross. Who is a Shakespeare scholar of considerable repute, and just a brilliant man, and I'm honored to have him as the first professor.
Absolutely. And you said you were a city kid. You're from the city of Rochester
originally? Yeah. Born and raised and educated in Rochester, East High School, and then on to the university. And then I strayed and went all the way down to Ithaca.
All the way to Ithaca. Well, we're going to have we're really lucky that we're going to get to hear Alan's long story poem, Memorial Day. It's being narrated by
Jonathan Foss. John is a friend of mine in Naples, Florida. His wife is my longtime paralegal. We have been working together. Our careers started in Rochester, New York, with the predecessor firm for Harter Secrest and Emery in the 1960s, and we've been working together ever since. And she's been instrumental in my practice and in my life, really.
And Jonathan's been training to do professional voiceover, so I'm looking forward to hearing it. I'm going to be getting the audio this week, but right now what I'm going to do is basically set you up. Can you tell us a little bit about the poem we're going to hear, Memorial Day?
Memorial Day?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's based upon a picture, the front page picture of the New York Times in May 30th of 2010, of a young widow dressed in black, seated in front of her husband's gravestone at Arlington, that was just so touching that, as I said before, I had to do something with it.
Picture's worth a thousand words. And the picture inspired what feels to me sometimes like I want to say it's operatic. It has these different parts, these different scenes. It's one story, one day, in the course of this one day in this cemetery, which is not Arlington, but it's sort of a similar to it. And this character, Old Stedman, who's a caretaker, and him seeing this poor widow and her, what she's going through, and how he's responding to her. And just in time for Memorial Day, we're going to be able to hear this poem, and the rest of it will be available on Alan's website, which I will link to along with this recording. Alan, before we get into it, is there anything you would like to say to our listeners about writing or about your life?
Well, to those who aspire, who want to do it, I say two simple words, go for it. I guess that's three
that's
words.
Three. Well, once again, Alan, thank you for being on the show. Listeners, I'd encourage you to check out MelioraPublications.com. That's Alan's website, and you'll be able to purchase and listen to Memorial Day there, as well as Alan's upcoming books. Alan, thanks again.
Well, thank you. My privilege.
Memorial Day. A story poem by Alan Hilfiker. Chapter 1. Sunrise. Out of the pearling gray, the sun coming low across the small rounded hills and the trees and the buildings in the distance, then above the fences and the hedges, coming on gradually, yet seeming still, seeming not to move, seeming not to rise. Only time stopped does it rise, imperceptibly does it rise, but inexorably it does rise, lightening the darkness, diluting the darkness, turning darkness gray, melting it slowly, silently, giving birth to shapes, giving birth to colors, bringing on the day. White markers, still gray in the gloaming, rising, rising, out of the dull, out of the dun, out of the gauzy haze, out of the dawning, like torsos, headless, armless, voiceless, ghostly rising, eloquently rising, waking, standing, coming to attention, quietly saluting the arrival of the sun. Chapter 2. Jennifer. She's the first to arrive, like a pilgrim, a lone pilgrim, waiting at the gate, a pilgrim burdened with grief, a pilgrim come to a sacred place, a pilgrim in search of peace, a pilgrim seeking relief, coming to lay her sorrow and a flower, waiting, waiting at the gate, well before the others, waiting there in darkness, waiting with her coffee, her thermos, her coffee growing cold, waiting in the morning chill, waiting for the sun to rise, a sweater draped across her shoulders, sleeves tied once across her chest, backpack hanging from her shoulders, backpack firm and fully stuffed, water for the day, small blanket just to sit on, salad for her lunch, yogurt for a snack, knife and fork and spoon, napkins too, and in her hand, in her rounded fist, a slender wooden stick, a flag upon a stick, still limp and hanging down, no breeze to wave it yet, to spread its red, its white, its blue, the colors of her land, the colors of her man, her country's flag. She's looking up and gazing off, gazing toward the distance, gazing to the east, to where sun will come, the sun still slowly rising, gazing toward the buildings of decisions, where options were discussed and plans were made, and arrows drawn, arrows on a map, circles on a map, circles moved upon a map, circles holding troops, circles meaning troops, individual men, circles holding men, circles shaping fates, individual fates, and once a circle's placed, decisions follow hence, and orders come, and fates are changed, individual fates, fates then moving forth, fates upon a course, something willed to happen, something bound to happen, events that will occur, like risings of the sun, inevitable, like the sun, inevitable and impacting, impacting lives of men, impacting other lives, and making markers rise, markers, stark and white, markers at attention, silently awaiting widows at the gate. Chapter 3. Old Stedman. Slowly he trudges, old Stedman, old Stedman out of the guardhouse, keys in his hand, trudging, trudging, shuffling over the lawn, onto the gravel, there by the gate, keys in his hand, old Stedman, looking down at his keys, fingering one, turning it out, out from the ring, out toward the lock, solitary, poised, inserting the key, snug in the lock, perfectly fit, turning it once, hearing it click, takes out the key. Another day, that's what it is, just another day. You see it in his eyes, the shuffle of his step, slouching as he moves. Old Stedman. Just another day, another year. Another set of flags. Fresh flags. Fresh flags carefully placed. Upright. Flags at full attention. Bolt. Upright. Upright and erect. Newly planted. Ramrod straight. Like soldiers at attention. One before each marker. One before each grave. Bright colors at attention. Bright reds. Bright whites. Bright blues. Bright colors, Stedman knows. Knows from years before. Knows from many years. Knows from fall and winter, too. Knows from days when flags are picked, when flags are pulled, when flags are pulled from frozen ground. Knows from past Decembers. Knows that colors fade. The reds, the whites, the blues. Even these, even reds and whites and blues, eventually will fade. Fade with rain, fade with snow, fade like all the others. Fade like memory, memory forgotten. Memories of men, memories of faces. Faces of fathers, fathers long forgotten by children not remembered. Names on stone. Names that wind and storms and time have worn. Names on scrolls, no longer read, fade like yesteryears. So too with coming years, fresh troops rappelling down, fresh troops in dusty towns, from house to house in dusty towns, fresh faces on the ground, fresh boots upon the ground, fresh faces bound for here, fresh colors coming here, with others yet to come, replacements yet to come, next wave of troops, troops rappelling down, replacing those replaced, and then themselves replaced. And so the cycle goes, this old Stedman knows. Knows the flags will fade, fade and be replaced. New sets of flags will come each year, like all the prior years, year on year on year. This old Stedman knows. Now at the gate, he pockets keys. Old Stedman pockets keys. Left pocket, as he always does. Looks up and sees her there. Old Stedman looks and sees her there. He smiles and sees her there. Sees Jennifer standing there. Sees her waiting, calm and poised. Waiting to come in, sees her smile returning his, and knows exactly who she is. Knows her story well. Knows her story all too well. Knows not her name, but knows her grief, her loss, her pain. She, like all the others, all those who've come before, all those who've gone before, he sees her pain, knows well her pain. He sees it in her eyes, the pain she shares, the wives, the lovers, the widows all those he's seen before, all those who've passed his gate, just like the flags. Fresh sets of wives, fresh sets of grief, arrive each year, arrive each spring of green, each spring of black, always they're in black. Standing there like flags, like silent standing flags, waiting to get in, slowly marching in spring, marching in time of green, marching in black.
Once again, this has been Memorial Day by Alan Hilfiker, read by Jonathan Foss. To hear the rest of Memorial Day, go to meliorapublications.com. That's MELIORAPUBLICATIONS.com. You can sign up for the Meliora Publications newsletter, get in contact with Alan, and listen to the rest of the download, find out more about Alan's upcoming books, and get to know him a little better. This has been Nina Alvarez, Lit Up with Nina Alvarez, and I will speak to you next week.